It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in this week for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the show, a new Wisconsin map exhibit tells us the story of who we are.
But first, we'll find out how a disastrous trip to Mexico inspired a fresh and delicious recipe that gives coleslaw a bit of a Mexican twist.
That innovative recipe landed our guest the top prize in NPR's Taste of Summer Recipe Contest.
Patricia Mulvey lives in Madison, and she's chef and co-owner of Local Time, a CSA and farmers market meal planning service. She joins us today to share some of her culinary secrets. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. But I do have to point out, I didn't win the top prize.
Oh, not the top prize.
No, oh. I was one of the top three.
Top three.
Oh, there we go. Well,
you won the important prize.
Thank you. Actually, a prize I did win that I hadn't anticipated was they've invited me to come back on the show in September on nice. NPR's Found Recipes again. So.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, as Rob mentioned, your recipe gives us a new twist on coleslaw. Tell us what an Ensenada slaw is.
I don't know if the name Ensenada slaw exists in Ensenada or not, but in Ensenada, almost any restaurant that you go to has this really delicious slaw that they tend to put on things like their fish tacos, and other such fresh dishes. And what makes it really delicious is it's got a little bit of lime juice for acidity, a little bit of hot sauce for some heat. And then I actually wrote the recipe using mayonnaise. That's how I developed it. But somebody since pointed out to me that they think it's actually made with crema, which is a Mexican thickened cream. So I'm going to have to try it that way, too.
Now, what I love about the recipe is the story behind it. What this could take a bit, but it's a crazy story that led to this funky coleslaw.
So, yes, and it's a very long story because it was a whole entire weekend's worth of adventures. And Melissa Gray on Found Recipes did an amazing job of compacting it and editing it down to just a few minutes. I'll do my best, too. But we were visiting a friend in San Diego, and we borrowed his car, my husband and I, and we drove down to Mexico, where we discovered that they use giant boulders as indicators that there's a construction zone ahead. And we discovered that by crashing into the boulder at about 60 miles an hour. There was a big dump truck in front of us, so it had enough clearance. We didn't see it coming. And so I decided not to crash into the oncoming cars to the left and not to dive off the cliff to the right. And I sacrificed the bottom of my friend's car for this. And we then had one thing after the next go wrong. I jumped out of the car. I waved down a tar rolling machine yelling, "Hay un gran pierna en la calle," which means there's a big leg in the street. I think I meant to say piedra, which means stone, which isn't right either, but it was closer. And then one thing after the next led to 3 days stuck in Ensenada, where we eventually gave up and left the car and went back and told our friend where his car was.
Oh, no. Yeah. But you got the slaw out of this because you were eating this maybe all 3 days?
Yes. Actually, we did go to the same restaurant every night because it was so good. And there's this beautiful mariachi band. They played Besame Mucho. And we discovered this unbelievably tasty slaw. And then I figured out how to make it.
Nice. How often do life events like that unexpectedly inspire your recipe?
Fortunately, I haven't had too many other life
events
quite like that one. But I do a lot of creating based on where I eat and travels. And we travel a fair amount. And so I'm forever trying to figure out the flavor profile and recreate recipes when I come
home. And how did you solve that mystery when you got home? How did you recreate that recipe?
Well, I remembered that it was acidic, so I assumed it would be lime juice, so that was easy right off the bat. I tried making the heat with hot peppers and didn't like that as much. It had the wrong flavor. And I just played with it until I found the Tabasco and realized that was the right flavor.
You do this a lot. You kind of reverse engineer recipes. You eat something somewhere and then, all right, how do they do that? And go home and try to figure it out?
All the time.
How often does it end in disaster?
Oh, boy. Honestly, I don't know. Does it end in disaster very often?
Usually come out with something pretty good?
I can usually come up with something pretty good. I am a trained professional.
Of course.
You know.
Disasters are our sort of thing, Rob.
Yeah, that's more my kind of cooking. Anyway, you say put this on the fish tacos. That's the best way to eat it?
I love it right on top of the taco. I usually do it on a soft tortilla, and then I'll put the slaw right in on top of it and roll it up and eat it that way.
If I try to make it at home, what kind of fish, how should I prepare it for the taco?
I like it with halibut, but that's a little bit costly, so you might want to go with something like a cod or another flaky white fish. And it's just a very simple spice rub, too, on there, and that's, I think that was cumin, lime, garlic. I don't have the whole thing off the top of my head, I don't think. But just a really nice sort of adobo-style spice rub, and pan sear that, and simple.
Do you find that people have a hard time figuring out what to do with cabbage besides a coleslaw? And where should they, I mean, what kind of ideas do you have?
Hold on, let me get a pen and paper. Yeah. I have two big heads of cabbage at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing when you see a beautiful little head of cabbage and then you start to slice it and it gets bigger somehow. I don't know how it grows when you cut it, but it's actually really funny. What I do for a living and at Local Time, where we do farmers market meal planning and CSA meal planning, is we solve that problem for people. We write recipes that use up all the vegetables that come in their box or that use whatever's being highlighted at the farmers market that particular week. And cabbage cooks beautifully. I love cabbage in soups. I love cabbage in stews. And it really wilts down. And so that's a good way to manage the volume, is to cook it. And I also really love to preserve food. So make a sauerkraut. Just rub it with salt and let it sit.
Well, I've talked to my Polish grandparents about making sauerkraut. And they have this very long thing that involves smells and a wooden barrel with a weight on it. There's an easy way to make sauerkraut?
Well, that's no. it's not easy in that it doesn't involve smells, and that it does get smelly. But you don't have to do anything once you put the salt in. You weight it down and allow the process to happen. And eventually, if you can stand the smell, eventually it turns into a very delectable product.
Could you treat it like lettuce? And I guess in my mind, I'm kind of equating your ensenada slaw to a little bit of a salad, where you put in some, I wouldn't think to put hot sauce in it, for example. So what kinds of other flavors should we try to inject into recipes like this?
You know, there's a really great cookbook that I just worked on. It's called Farm Fresh and Fast, and it's a fundraiser for the CSA Coalition. And one thing that we do in there is we talk about variations on recipes. And so we do a master concept, so a master recipe for a slaw, which gives you a basic outline, but then it gives you maybe 8 different flavor profiles that you can add in. So if you take the flavor profile of any country, say Indonesia, which is going to have molasses and peanuts and a little bit of a sweet soy, that's a slaw recipe right there. Hmm. Take the flavor profile of Greece and you put in some dill and some lemon and some olive oil and some feta, and there's a whole different slaw. So you can just sort of bounce those different types of flavor profiles around to create different toppings.
Nice.
So you can just kind of wing it, like, all right, I'm going to go Indonesian today. I've got these ingredients.
Yep, very much so.
Well, that sounds fun. I should check that out. So I want to know, you were in this contest. Has fame changed you now? Are you getting a lot of attention?
I don't think I'm famous. actually, the week of the contest, there were quite a few phone calls from reporters and all of that sort of thing. That was fun. It's nice to try to get the word out about the company and the work that we're doing, because I think people really could benefit from having access to our online source of really good recipes that focus on vegetables.
Well, where can people find more recipes before their next trip to the farmers market?
Localtime.net.
And that's time spelled like
T-H-Y-M-E.
The herb, yes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patricia Mulvey, she runs... she's the co-owner and chef for Local Time, a CSA and farmers market meal planning service based in Madison. You can find Patricia's award-winning recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll look at a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Society about the maps that tell us who and where we are. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Maps tell us a lot more than how to get from point A to point B. They tell us things like what their makers think are important.
Like the number of logging trails in Wisconsin or a water route to take from point A to point B.
The Wisconsin Historical Society opened its maps exhibit in April, and it will be closing this fall. So we'll be taking a last look at it today.
David Driscoll joins us. He's curator of business and technology at the Wisconsin Historical Society. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
When are most of the maps from in your exhibit?
It's hard to answer because there are two phases of the exhibition. The part that went up in the spring covers a great deal of time from the early 19th century up to today. The enhanced version that we sometimes call the treasures version that went in at the beginning of the summer features some of our oldest and rarest materials, and those go back to, I think, the earliest map we have is 1513.
And what is that map, the 1513?
That is a map of the world done by Martin Waldseemüller, who was a, German, yes, German cartographer, who was basing the map on the map of the world done by Ptolemy in the ancient world, updated with the most recent information he had about explorations.
And some gaps in there, I'm assuming, along the way.
Yes, it's inaccurate, shall we say.
Now, I was going through a list of a lot of the maps there, and there really are different ways of looking at the world. And just for example, in the last few weeks, I've been up in Tomahawk, on the Wisconsin River, and in La Crosse, on the Mississippi, over in Milwaukee at the Art Museum overlooking Lake Michigan. And it just makes me think about the huge role water plays in shaping the world, of course, and our state in particular. You've got some water-oriented maps in the exhibit, I think.
Well, that was one of the first things that I thought of. Sort of before the highway maps and the systems that we're familiar, you know, the graphic systems we're familiar with today, what the first European explorers looked at was the waterways, how to get from here to there, because there were no roads, railroads, that sort of thing. And actually, one of my favorite maps is a modern one that's kind of done in the style of the London subway map that most people are probably familiar with. But it's the river systems of the upper Midwest. And the fellow that designed that, who's a Madisonian, was explicitly thinking of waterways as travel routes and put a kind of modern graphic design spin on that. So we have some very early explorers' maps of the upper Midwest waterways, as well as some very contemporary ones.
I love looking at maps of rivers and thinking about the world that way, because right now, of course, we look at a map and the main feature on it is the highway system. And it's just, yes, it seems it's a totally different worldview in how you get from place to place.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I like about those early maps is that there are no kind of state boundaries. We're so used to thinking of there's a huge difference between us and Illinois. But when you actually look at river systems, it's all kind of integrated. It's not, you know, kind of geographically separate.
Yeah, some of the borders make sense, of course. Lake Michigan over there and Lake Superior up there, the Mississippi over there. But maps are so subject to political whim sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Depending on where you are, we do have a map in up through September 7th in the treasures part. That kind of shows an early version of Wisconsin that sort of included Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, and also Chicago. And by the time the sort of political deal-making was done, Chicago was in Illinois, and, you know, we stopped shy of the Twin Cities.
And the Upper Peninsula was in Michigan for some reason.
Right. And that was part of the trade-off.
Right. And then, of course, a lot of the maps were made not for travel or tourism, but for economic reasons. And one of the maps that interested me in the exhibit, logging trails. Not there anymore for the most part, but logging trails in Wisconsin.
Well, that's actually a fascinating map that wasn't done contemporaneously with those logging trails. This was a guy who realized years after the fact that there was tons of usually narrow gauge logging railroads throughout particularly the northern part of the state that were never recorded anywhere. So he took standard USGS survey maps and did a ton of research, walked through the woods following trails, and basically mapped all of this material in the 70s and 80s that there's just no evidence for anywhere else. And that's one of the points we're trying to make in the treasures phase. Some of the treasures are old, rare, and valuable. Others are treasures because of the incredible information that they carry.
That sounds like quite a bit of detective work there on that one.
Yeah, he worked for years on it. He was hoping to publish a book, but he died before that happened.
What are some of the other treasures that really caught your eye in the exhibit?
There's two ways to answer that. There's the old and rare and unusual, which most people would agree are treasures. Maps done by Hennepin or other explorers of the upper Midwest in the 1600s, early 1700s. And then there are others that I find I would call treasures just because they're so interesting. And there's a pair that we are including of sort of residential patterns by race in Milwaukee. And there are two versions of that. One maps that information by census tract. So there are blocks. And then there's another more recent version that does that using dots. And each dot represents 25 citizens. And on the block map, you get a real distinction of this neighborhood is white, this is black, this is Latino. On the dot map, the dots are much more interwoven and overlaid, and you just get a much more subtle view of what's actually happening in Milwaukee. And that's one of the points that I think was most fascinating about this project, was what maps can tell you, what they don't tell you, and what the mapping techniques hide or reveal.
And that reminds me, you also have maps of immigrants in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
How do they tell that story?
That actually is a project that goes back to right around the turn of the last century. The earliest sort of Wisconsin ethnicity map was done in the 1890s. And I think that's kind of, that's the closing of the frontier, that's sort of leading into the immigration restriction era in the sort of early 20th century. And I think people are just starting to realize that Wisconsin is peopled by different European immigrants. And they're starting to map that. Later on, that became a project that the Department of Rural Sociology at the UW did. We have a number of maps that were generated through that effort. And it follows the same kinds of patterns as the earlier ones, but eventually they wind up being used for different purposes. And that information, being sort of university public information, was shared with the public. And one of the Milwaukee papers published a version of that just before World War II, before the U.S. entered World War II. And the whole subtext of that and the captions for the maps are, look how well America does at integrating different ethnic communities. And it's kind of, in contrast to what's happening in Europe, this is a model of cooperation and peace. And, so it's kind of this propaganda thing in the context of the war. But it's very interesting, different use of that kind of information.
And now looking to the future, I understand the Historical Society has digitized a lot of the maps in the collection. Tell us about that ongoing project.
That has been going on for, I guess, since about 2009. And there's the Casambas Foundation has funded that. So we've had people in the archives cataloging and digitizing maps. So we have high-resolution scans. We're up to about 3,000 of those now online. People can search the website and find all kinds of great stuff. On the other hand, there's nothing like seeing the real thing. So that's why we wanted to get the physical objects out, at least for a little while this summer.
And just briefly, tell us the where, when, and how long it's going of the exhibit.
The exhibition is up at the Wisconsin Historical Museum on Capitol Square, across from the Vets Museum at the end of State Street. And we're open 9 to 4, Tuesday through Saturday. The treasures portion of the exhibit will be up through September 7th, a Saturday, and the rest of the exhibition will be up through November 8th.
David, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks very much.
That's David Driscoll, Curator of Business and Technology at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be taking a new look at the Vietnam War with bestselling author Nick Terse.
We'll also hear about a new technology that could help cancer patients keep their hair during chemo.
And we'll talk about the budding startup community in Milwaukee.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in today for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy last month, as we discussed on the show when it happened. The city was an industrial giant tied deeply to its auto manufacturing roots.
But a contributing factor to its demise was the loss of those manufacturing jobs. It has many folks in Wisconsin wondering, is Milwaukee the next Detroit? That's what our next guest, Bruce Murphy, asks in a recent column for Urban Milwaukee.
And we want to know what you think. What does the future hold for Milwaukee? Was it too tightly connected to manufacturing? Does it need a new economy? What would that look like? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Bruce Murphy is the editor of Urban Milwaukee, where he writes the Murphy's Law column. He joins us today to discuss this issue. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here. That's actually urbanmilwaukee.com.
.com, thank you. Bruce, why do you think people want to, are compelled to compare Milwaukee to Detroit?
Well, my guess is that there may be other Rust Belt cities where that discussion has gone on as well, perhaps in cities like Cleveland or Buffalo. But there are some clear parallels here. You know, they're both Rust Belt cities that depended heavily on manufacturing. They're both northern cities, and they're both cities that have high poverty. You know, when you take a look at rankings of cities by the percent of children living in poverty, Detroit was first place with 57%, and Milwaukee is fourth place with 43%. So there are definitely some parallels there that would help prompt this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about how the recession impacted the city, you know, due to its ties to manufacturing. Can you give us some of the details?
Well, actually, you know, I think you can go all the way back to the early 80s, and there's been a precipitous decline in manufacturing going all the way back to then. Definitely the Great Recession had a significant impact, and not just on manufacturers, but also just on just plain old businesses. It could be restaurants and so on. And beyond that, for the city itself, for the city government, the big issue was, you know, for a city, what you're really trying to do, your business is to try to drive property tax base, because that's where you get your money. And pretty much most development dried up because nobody could get any financing after the Great Recession, and that had a huge impact on Milwaukee as it did on other cities.
Mm. So what's needed to revive the economy, especially now?
In Milwaukee?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think that really it has a lot of strengths, but if you look at, you can really look at the whole state, and this has been a heavily manufacturing state, second only to Indiana, and, you know, a lot of manufacturing jobs have been gone and have been lost, and I think one thing that this state has tried to do, you had manufacturers who've tried to do higher-end manufacturing that kind of combines with some kind of high-tech stuff. Beyond that, obviously, there's lots of discussion about trying to drive, create new businesses statewide as well as in Milwaukee. And, you know, that's a big issue there's been a lot of discussion about, and I think it's not an easy thing to completely transform your economy, and I think that's an issue for Milwaukee and for the state as well.
It sounds like there still might be some, I guess, some challenges in the way of revitalizing Milwaukee. One of them might be the changes to the residency requirements. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's a big blow. That's a very big blow. There are two issues that have really that's an issue because the ending a city's residence requirement basically means there are estimates that as many as 50% of city government employees could leave the city. That's based on the track record in other cities that ended residency requirements. And that's also based on the fact that about 50% of city retirees end up moving to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So if that happens, and it would take some years probably, but that could have a fairly significant impact on the property tax base. It's probably going to lower home values. You've got less people buying to buy houses.
I'm wondering what the if that were to happen and we lose 50% of government employees to nearby suburbs, what, if anything, would a thriving suburban economy do for Milwaukee?
Well, you know, it's a metro area, so it's not as though those boundaries don't necessarily stop the economy from rippling over and influencing each other. So, yeah, there's... Just because they've moved from a business perspective, that doesn't necessarily change things. But, they're still probably living in the area. I mean, if they're working, you've still got businesses in the area. But from a residential property tax-based perspective, it is definitely a problem.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Mayor Tom Barrett opened the door to the Detroit-Milwaukee comparison. How did he do that?
Yeah, he basically said, you know, if you want the tax base of Milwaukee to resemble a tax base of Detroit, ending the residency requirement, that's the way to do it. So he was really, it's a pretty stark warning. I honestly don't think things will get that bad, but as I say, it's going to have a significant impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is Mayor Barrett doing, or what can he do to have any sort of influence over the situation?
Well, they are suing, so they're going to court to try to strike down the state law, and that gets to the issue of home rule for cities. The city has had a residency requirement going back to the 1930s, and there is a lot of case law suggesting that the city has a lot of autonomy over what it does, but I think in most cases the state power tends to trump that, so it will depend on how the courts rule.
Mm-hmm. I'm Cynthia Schuster talking with Bruce Murphy. He's editor of UrbanMilwaukee.com, and we're talking about the future of the Milwaukee economy, whether Milwaukee might be the next Detroit, and taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Bruce, talk about on a county level, is the county board taking a look at the situation, and do they have a stake in the matter?
It's really a separate government, and the residency requirement for the county has never been as big an issue because there are a lot of suburbs within the county where people can live, and it just has never played out in the same way that it does for a city. So I would say it's not a major issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, Detroit's urban flight is almost unparalleled by any other American city. How does Milwaukee compare on this matter?
Well, I think there's definitely been white flight over the years. A big issue for middle-class families is the schools. And so Milwaukee Public Schools has arguably declined over the years in terms of average achievement level of students. And so you have people who, once they have kids, they may move out of the city. You also have empty nesters who, once their kids are gone, they may move back downtown and buy a condo. There's been a lot of that in the last 15 years. But definitely that's probably the main driver of some middle-class people leaving the city. The advent of school choice has made some difference, perhaps. But there's definitely an issue there for the city that it still needs to wrestle with.
Mm-hmm. Well, despite some of the challenges we're hearing about, you had mentioned a Brookings Institute study that said that Milwaukee actually stands out as the best large city in America when it comes to increasing jobs within a 3-mile radius, I suppose, of downtown. Why is that? What is to account for its success?
You know, I have to say, when I found that study, I was really surprised. I mean, I do think that there's been a lot of good news in Milwaukee. I write about it regularly, but still, this basically took a look at large cities, and 44 of the 45 large cities have seen a decrease in the percentage of jobs located within 3 miles of their central business district. The only exception was Milwaukee, and Milwaukee saw an increase. So that's a big deal. That means that jobs are nearby to people, you know, perhaps low-income people who may not even have access to a car. They're more likely to be nearby so that they can get to them. As to why, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that there's been a long-term program to try to redevelop the Menominee Valley in the center of the city, which was basically a classic Rust Belt situation. Most of the manufacturing and the old trains and whatnot had all disappeared from the valley. And the city has done a very good job of reclaiming the valley, of getting rid of, you know, toxic areas, of creating green spaces, trying to reclaim the river, and build up a lot of clean industry around that. So that's really brought jobs to the city. And the other thing is the mayor was successful in convincing Manpower, a major international company that was located in a suburb of Milwaukee, to move its headquarters downtown. And that brought about 900 jobs into the center of the city.
Hmm. Well, we'll continue our conversation with Bruce Murphy. He's the editor of UrbanMilwaukee.com, and we'll talk about the future of Wisconsin's biggest city.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you moved to Milwaukee recently? Tell us why. Have you moved out of Milwaukee? Tell us that, too. If you're watching from elsewhere in the state, what do you think? Are you optimistic about Milwaukee's future? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster.
We're talking with Bruce Murphy, editor of UrbanMilwaukee.com. We're talking about his piece, Is Milwaukee the Next Detroit?
And we want to know what you think. Are you concerned about Milwaukee's economic future? Are you skeptical that Milwaukee and Detroit even compare in this way? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go straight to the phones. We've got Charlie in Milwaukee waiting for us. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Wonderful program. I got to say, I love Milwaukee. I grew up here, and I think it's the greatest city on earth. In terms of the residency, my question is, why not give people incentives of the Milwaukee County employees or the city employees to live within the city? Give them an incentive financially if they choose to live in the city, while not denying great teachers or great firemen or great policemen. If they choose to live outside, they could do it, but they're not going to make as much money.
Yes, well, actually, the city has just passed a law that will do that exactly. That if you decide to live outside the city, you won't get raises. So there is going to be a financial impact. The big problem for the city, though, is that they cannot do that to police and fire workers, which is about half of all their half of their entire budget is spent on fire and police workers. Because Act 10 exempted them, they still have collective bargaining rights, and basically under the current contract, there's nothing they can do to reward them or punish them based on where they live.
Have other cities done that, and how has that impacted things?
I'm not sure. There are a wide variety of things that cities have done in terms of handling residency, and I'm just not sure what the impact has been depending on what they've done. But definitely Milwaukee is committed to trying to do this. They recently passed that law, and so we'll see what the impact is.
Let's go next to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I don't really see Milwaukee headed towards a situation like Detroit. Detroit's economy was so completely dominated by the auto industry, and a shift of the auto industry from that city to southern states and to areas outside the United States was dramatic and swift, and the diversification of Milwaukee into smaller industries and industries which are not so heavily dominated by one specific component like Ford or General Motors, I think differentiates us substantially. I think it also differentiates us in a way that maybe we could look toward a city that is doing substantially better than Milwaukee, which would be Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities. And their differentiation is, I think, even to a greater degree, where we don't have a national bank here anymore that's headquartered here anymore. We had, you know, a regional bank with M&I, and prior to that with First Wisconsin being acquired, and then subsequently acquired again and acquired again. U.S. Bank headquartered in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some other substantial banking interests there as well. They seem to have a greater diversification along the lines of things like chemical and agricultural that we don't have, and that we should really continue with that. I think the biggest jeopardy to Wisconsin and to Milwaukee is what's happening on the education front going forward. You've got a lot of the young people, a lot of talent, and the potential that the University of Wisconsin system is going to suffer is going to affect directly the city of Milwaukee along with the rest of the state.
What about that, Bruce Murphy? Is Milwaukee more protected than Detroit because of its economic diversity?
I don't think there's any question. That's absolutely true. Detroit was so dependent on cars, and Milwaukee is much more diversified. I also think it's true, as the listener suggests, that Milwaukee needs to increase that diversification. You know, one really good sign for the city is that it is, and this was not true years ago, but is doing a very good job of attracting college graduates. There was a USA Today analysis of census data which found big increase in college grads flocking to cities, and the average increase was 17%, but it was 45% in Milwaukee. Why does that matter? Because I think if you want to diversify your economy, you need brains. You know, you need to have smart people gather in one place, and good things often arise from that for the economy. So I think that's another good sign for Milwaukee.
Should we be concerned about what types of jobs these young people are taking? Are they primarily part-time, full-time, and does it matter?
I think it does matter, and I think it's a cinch that a lot of these folks probably have jobs in restaurants and bars. As we know, a lot of that is happening with this generation. But still, they're spending money in the city, that money circulates, and it has a good effect, and you hope eventually that they'll move into other jobs.
Let's take a call from Curtis in Juneau.
Yes, hi, thanks for taking my call. Appreciate the program. How can we expect to revitalize Milwaukee or any of the other major cities or even the smaller cities when we don't revise our tax code? Right now, it is profitable for a corporation to move their jobs out of not only the larger cities, but overseas, and the individuals that are left behind that have lost their jobs are faced with the problem of how do we revitalize the city? Now, your speaker said that the college graduates and everything coming back into Milwaukee. What type of jobs are they getting? Are they middle income or are they lower paying?
Bruce Murphy?
Well, you know, I think, as I said, I think it's a cinch. A number of these people are probably working in restaurants and bars, and that's maybe not ideal, but they're making money that turns over in the city. But I think you raise an important point, which is that a city is not an island, and the national policies and state policies can have a significant impact on a city, and obviously you have had, going back to the 1980s, a lot of manufacturers who have moved jobs to the South and then to other countries, and that's had a big impact on all of these Rust Belt cities.
We got an email from Dale in Mequon. He says, far too many people come into any discussion of Milwaukee with the preconceived notion that the city is crumbling, a crumbling, dying place. Yet they have very little current day experience with the true strengths and weaknesses of Milwaukee. Are people overly pessimistic about Milwaukee, Bruce?
Honestly, I think that people who've spent time here recently are amazed at what is going on. The city is really in a renaissance. I mean, there has just been this explosion of restaurants, bars, retail, younger residents, going all the way across the city, the entire area of the city along the lake from far north side to far south side. There's just been all kinds of redevelopment. It's an amazing phenomenon. And it's, there's just a lot more entertainment. It's a much more exciting city than it was years ago. So in a way, it's really, there's tremendous stuff going on there, but it's sort of a tale of two cities. There's also large sections of the city that have significant poverty, crime, and all the bad things that spring from poverty. So it's a very complex situation, like a lot of cities. Lots of good news and lots of bad news.
Well, can the good news be built upon? Where did the Renaissance come from, and what more can we learn from that?
I think that one thing that Tom Barrett's predecessor, Mayor John Norquist, pretty much proved is that development is a key thing, that a mayor who cares about design and how buildings look and trying to figure out ways to encourage development, that can have a huge impact in helping to a city to go through a renaissance as Milwaukee has done. So that's certainly one thing you can do. I think the other thing, one thing that Barrett has been trying to do is to mitigate poverty. So they've had programs specifically designed to try to reduce infant mortality and to try to reduce teen pregnancy, and they've actually made tremendous strides with that. And that's, that just helps to mitigate the impact of poverty. When you talk about teen mothers, there's a cycle of poverty that's repeated. The teen mother ends up having a daughter who becomes a teen mother, and so on. If you can cut into that and end that cycle, that can have a tremendously positive impact for the city.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Bruce Murphy is the editor of UrbanMilwaukee.com and author of the recent article, Is Milwaukee the Next Detroit?
Coming up, it's Shark Week, and sharks around the world are facing serious threats. We'll talk about that in a few minutes with a shark conservationist. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.